It's called Radio Survives and Thrives, the History of Kentucky Broadcasting from 1945 to 1970. They can find it at Amazon.com, both in Kindle and in regular print. And they also can find it at Barnes & Noble under their Nook section. It's the print version isn't available at Barnes & Noble, but the Nook version is for those who have electronic readers. Okay, my name's Ken McHarg. I have experience in radio. I worked for a number of years, about 8 or 9 years, part-time at various Louisville, Kentucky area radio stations. And then my wife and I went to Ecuador for 8 years, where we worked at an international Christian shortwave radio station, HCJB, the Voice of the Andes. Also done a lot of freelance stuff, like for ABC News, UPI Radio, and Monitor Radio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have a broad media and writing background. I'm particularly interested in radio and radio history. I just kind of eat it up. I enjoy it. I grew up during the golden age of radio in Detroit back in the late 40s, early 50s. Even got to meet the Lone Ranger once at summer camp, and that was a pretty exciting thing. And just have always loved radio and kind of paid attention both to the older radio and the newer formats. And that's where the book Radio Survives and Thrives came from. First of all, the spark was my long-standing interest in radio, in all forms of radio, AM, FM, shortwave, the whole gamut of radio. Once again, growing up in a radio town of Detroit, we had a lot of great stations like WJR and WWJ and WXYZ and CKLW. And then you could hear all the surrounding stations from Chicago and Cleveland and everywhere else. And I enjoyed the long-distance listening, the DXing part of it. I enjoyed listening to it. Always kind of wanted to be in radio. In 1993, when we were back in Louisville for a six-month furlough from Ecuador, a friend of mine, Dr. Gail Henson, at Bellarmine College, now called Bellarmine University, had been asked by another gentleman up in near Ashland, Kentucky, to help him write a book on the history of Kentucky. This was being done under the sponsorship or interest of the Kentucky Broadcasters Association. And he asked her to write some, and he was going to write some. And she asked me to write a chapter on broadcasting, particularly radio, between the end of World War II, 1945, and 1970, give or take. And so I did. I wrote this as a chapter for that book. Well, to make a long story short, that arrangement did not work out. The gentleman, Francis Nash from Kentucky Christian College, ended up writing the book himself. And it was published by Host and Associates. It was done under the auspice of Kentucky Broadcasters. I find a few copies still left on Amazon.com, but not very many. Meanwhile, this chapter, which to me contained a lot of information, I drew a lot of it from old newspaper clippings from the library. I went and interviewed some of the personalities of those days, like Johnny Randolph and WKLO and others. And it seemed to me it was good material, and whereas Mr. Nash had used some of it very lightly in his book, most of it did not get into that book, and therefore it is unpublished. And for a long time, I've tried to find out how can I publish this book, or not a book. It's really more of a 60-page booklet, I guess you would call it. And I tried once or twice to get it published by a historical organization in Kentucky, and it was too long for their publications, and it kind of sat. Until all of a sudden, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, to be honest with you, I realized that with the new way of publishing on demand through Amazon.com and through Kindle and Nook, I could, to be honest with you, for free, put the publication online, publish it, sell it. It could get into people's hands. It could be part of the material that's available on the history of broadcasting in Kentucky. And it would not be a big expense. I don't know how much you know about book publishing, but if you try to go and publish, let's say, 1,000 copies of a 100-page book, you're out a couple thousand dollars. And then you have to publicize it, and sometimes you're left with a whole room full of books. This way, I'm not left with a whole room full of books. And people are buying it. I've had quite a number of people who've gone ahead and bought it online. So the book came out of that long process, but just recently I decided it's still good material. It's historic material, so why not make it available to those who are interested in radio history and Kentucky history? And, you know, it really looks not only at radio history in Kentucky, but it sets it in the broad context of what was happening in radio broadcasting during that time. Television was coming in. Radio was changing from network, the golden age of dramas and musicals and comedies, to disc jockey formats. FM was coming and growing at that point. Television was taking some of the entertainers from radio and putting them on TV. That's a national context, and Kentucky was right in the middle of that, in that WGRC, which later became Wacky, W-A-K-Y, under Gordon McGlendon, was one of the very first stations in the country to go with the Top 40 format. McGlendon bought the station, changed the format, put it on the air, and it just jumped to number one within a period of months, and was really part of the forefront of that change to format radio from the old days of more programmed radio. First of all, I think a kind of an interesting story. When WGRC changed to Wacky, they stunted for 3 or 4 days, and they played the Purple People Eater. And they would say, that song was from Frank Sinatra, next coming up, something from Bing Crosby. Then they played the Purple People Eater. And then they come say, that was Bing Crosby. Now here's Patti Page singing such and such, and they play the Purple People Eater. And it was one of the first times I've ever heard of stunting being used in radio. And it was certainly a radical way to change formats. And when you realize the difference between the old station and the new, you realize what a revolutionary form of broadcasting was being developed. A guy named Jerry Fordyce was an announcer in the old days of WGRC, the 40s and the 50s. Jerry was one of these gentlemen with a golden, deep, resonant voice. Really nice guy. I used to work with him at WXVW. And he would talk about the fact that during the golden age of radio, when it was WGRC and it was a mutual network, he would go to work at night dressed up in a suit, sometimes a tux, and would sit at the station and all dressed up like that in order to say at the top of the hour, this is WGRC Louisville, and do some other announcements like that. You realize the formality of radio in the old days. And, of course, Jerry also did a lot of network programming for Mutual. Nat King Cole, Bing Crosby, others would come to Kentucky. Mutual would do a remote of their presentation, and Jerry would be the announcer on the network. Of course, Jerry made the transition over into, I don't think he did rock radio, but he did news for Wacky for a while, then went to some other stations and eventually ended up working at WXVW. But he talked about the radical change. Other stations in Kentucky did the same thing. WVLK in Lexington changed from, you know, more traditional standards, softer, more traditional music to rock, and got letters from, excuse me, he got letters from churches and pastors and other people condemning them for it. And yet that station blossomed and became a number one station in Lexington for many, many years. Meanwhile, a lot of other stations were coming on the air throughout the state. And it was interesting, as I wrote the book and researched it and told some of their stories in the book, how much community service these people were involved in. Storm reporting, news reporting, all this kind of thing. They did even little stations did a whole lot of that, a lot more than you hear done on the radio today. They also did a lot of live radio, live music. I remember way back in the must be the early 50s when my dad took me, the first time I ever went to a radio station, took me to WJR in Detroit for the Bud Guest program, Guest House. And it was exciting to sit there and watch his live band. Well, a lot of these little stations across Kentucky in small towns like London and Madisonville and Bowling Green, et cetera, had music, usually country music groups, that would come in and would sing on the air. Some of them went on to things like Grand Ole Opry and other, you know, big national country music programs. But a lot of them got their start at small stations in Kentucky that broadcast way up into the 60s, were broadcasting live music from their studios. I do know that when the stations changed to the Top 40 format, their advertising loads sold out right away. They made a lot of money. They also could operate that with fewer broadcasters. I'm trying to find in the book now, 1947, I think it was, WHAS put out a supplement journal and told that how many people they had employed with the station doing programming. You know, people on staff that did a half-hour program a day or an hour program a day or had multiple staffs on the air. And I can't find that right now in the book. I may find it as we continue to talk. But, you know, they dropped from some stations from 100 employees down to maybe you needed 6 or 8 disc jockeys on the air. Then you get a guy like Gary Burbank who comes on that does so many voices and personalities by himself. It sounds like you got a whole staff and you got one guy or maybe two guys who are doing this. So the economics were that format top formatted radio was cheaper to do and their advertising filled up. It also was very creative. When I talked to Johnny Randolph, who was one of the program directors in those days, he talks about stunts like they flew a plane over right between the buildings in downtown Louisville and dropped things out for people to pick out. And other times they had, and the pilot got his license suspended for that. Another guy, another promotion they did was to plant something that people had to go find. Well, it turns out they one place they went looking for it was on the flood wall across the river in either Clarksville or Jeffersonville. And the people, the listeners looking for that item, tore up the flood wall to the point that the radio station had to spend a lot of money putting it back together. So another station in Ashland, Kentucky, they had a guy sitting on a platform for days and days and days, kind of one of those, you know, sit on a pole type people. Just all kinds of stunts that they did to attract attention. One station, I think it was Wacky, had lights in the window, different colors. And a song that was really rockish, the lights would be red. A little smoother, it might be blue, that kind of thing. All kinds of promotional stuff that you probably don't hear much about today in radio. Well, it's changed because essentially we've gone back to network radio. It's syndicated, but you know, all of the talk shows we have and even some of the syndicated formats, they don't come from your local station. They come from somewhere else. We're back to what we had in the days of network radio, where programming comes from somewhere else and is carried by a local station. So it's been an interesting recycling of sources in the more modern age. And of course, I don't cover the modern age in this booklet, but nevertheless, I think it's interesting to see how we've kind of cycled back. Well, one of the personalities that came out of Kentucky Broadcasting, and it was a television personality, was a young woman who did the weather forecast at WLKY, Channel 32 in Louisville, after it opened up. And she was announced as being a former beauty queen and opera star, is going to give the weather. And she came on and she did the weather for several years before she went on to work for ABC and CBS. Her name is Diane Sawyer. You probably have heard of her. She's quite well known, of course. Her father was a judge in Kentucky, and she was quite well known. Of course, you know, some of the older entertainers, Rosemary Clooney was from Kentucky, and there were others who started at some of the stations in Louisville and Lexington, and even at some of the country stations, stations down in the country, some of the stations in small towns, and were going. Some of them were music people who went on from there, too. But I think one of the best-known ones is Diane Sawyer. Of course, the various singers would come through, and in those days, they broadcast a lot of the concerts, as I mentioned. Jerry Fordyce on the Mutual Network did a lot of the programming, for the network with people who came to Kentucky to broadcast. And, of course, part of that was promotion. They would sell records that way and all that kind of thing, too. They also, I think, yes, there were more interviews in those days. There were more personalities who would come through and who were trying to promote a book or trying to promote their music, that kind of thing. Probably more that you have today. Some stations do interviews, but once again, a lot of the music stations are picking up syndicated formats from somewhere else. And so those people are not locally, even if they have a performer on. They don't have as many on now as they used to. Well, radio's changed a lot, so has TV, but I think probably there were more changes in the late 50s, early 60s than maybe at any other time in radio, because of the change from the golden age of radio, the programming type concept, to the formatted type programming, and the development of FM, which put a lot more stations on the air, offered more of a music format, music variety, offered a different quality. Radio didn't change again. Excuse me, I'm fighting an allergy. It didn't change again until really the 1980s, when AM radio was kind of felt to be dead because FM radio had become so predominant. And then Rush Limbaugh went on with his talk show, which now has led to all this talk radio that we have today. That was another time of change, although it happened faster, I think, than it did in the 50s and 60s, as the stations really had to be dragged out of what they were doing. Matter of fact, about the time that Wacky was changed, it was changed to Top 40, WHAS announced a 5-year program to try to modernize the station and bring it up more to what, you know, radio was becoming. It Wacky did it in 2 or 3 days. They went from the traditional state program network type stuff to Top 40 in about 3 days. WHAS took 5 years in the late 60s, early 70s, late 50s, early 60s to change to more of a disc jockey, more of a local programming type of format. 5 years. Now, granted, WHAS, 50,000 watts, covers the whole state. It's the main news source for the state. Local stations didn't have quite the coverage and maybe had a little different broadcasting responsibility. But nevertheless, it took a big station like that 5 years to change. Other people that started in Louisville, you asked that question a minute ago, for example, were Don McNeil, who did the Breakfast Club on ABC for many years, and Marianne Luckett, who appeared regularly on that program. They were from Louisville and started on WHAS. And I'm sure there were many others. I don't have a lot of them listed in the book. It was interesting, though, how personalities developed on the radio. In those days, in the 60s, late 50s, a rising young star that stations were changing networks to get was a guy named Paul Harvey. And it was a station in New Albany, Indiana, that had Paul Harvey, and then WHAS went to ABC. But ABC allowed the New Albany station to continue with Paul Harvey. And the program director there said he was happy they did because he basically built his entire station around Paul Harvey's newscast. And then you know how many years Paul Harvey was on the air. Just tremendous number of decades. And for all those decades was the number one or very close to the number one listened to radio personality across the country. So his roots come out of this era of change and an era – interestingly enough, when stations were going to on-the-hour news and less programming, his newscast remained as a program feature on stations for years and years and years. Among the very first stations in the state were WHAS in Louisville. WLAP in Lexington actually started in Louisville and moved to Lexington. It was the first station in Lexington. The old WAVE, Wave Radio 970 in Louisville, was an early station on the air. Most of the other small town stations that you read about in the book came on in the 40s and 50s. WXVW, the station I worked at across the river in Jeffersonville, came on the air in the early 50s. And yet is seen as one of the heritage stations there, you know, given the fact of new stations that have come on FM. There were some other ones. There was WSPD in Paducah. It was on for many, many, many years. But those ones I mentioned, WHAS, WAVE, WLAP, were some of the first ones in the state to come on the air. Well, initially, you only had, you didn't have a lot of recorded music. Much music in the very, very early days of radio, I'm talking about the 20s and the 30s, was live because recordings were not as common. They were harder to get. There wasn't a lot of interconnection between stations early on. So a lot of that music was live. And that's the kind of tradition that continued down all the way into the 50s and 60s on a lot of Kentucky stations where local groups came in and provided music. Now, of course, you had more and more records in the 40s and 50s and 60s. But live music was very much the fare of radio way, way, way back. Interesting. It was interesting. I was just talking to a gentleman here in town. You know, I live in Carrollton, Georgia now, and I was talking to a gentleman here in town who was talking about the local AM station here in Carrollton, WLBB, which came on in the 40s. He said this station was so unconnected from the rest of the world, they did not have network connections here, that when the Korean War ended in the early 1950s, they did not hear about it till the next morning when the Atlanta paper came out and they saw it in the paper and put it on the air. This is kind of what you were dealing with in some of the older days of radio. You certainly didn't have satellite connections. Do you remember the old days of radio, network radio, when it goes silent and people would come on and say, "One moment, please. Due to difficulties beyond our control, we are unable to continue with this program. Please stand by." And then there'd be silence. You seldom see that now. on television or on network radio or satellite connections, the backup connections. We have all kinds of interconnectivity. So in the early days of radio, you dealt with a lot of live music, live drama. You had some of the dramas were recorded, and we do have a lot of dramas and radio programs that we have recordings of, but those are recorded live off the air. A lot of those old-time radio programs you buy. Consultants came in and didn't know a community. They were bringing a national, national pattern, cookie-cutter pattern to use, but that doesn't always work with a local station that has 30, 40, 50, 60 years of local service. And credibility among people. If there's going to be a storm warning, school's going to be closed. If there's news, sports they want to hear, they've depended on those stations for years. And I think that's been very disruptive to a lot of formats. There is a move in current radio to try to move stations back to more local programming. I've noticed that one Atlanta station that went all syndicated talk has now added some local talk back into their format. Because I think people get tired of you turn across the 50,000 watt clear channel stations at night, and with a few exceptions like WSM and a few others, it's all syndicated stuff. You hear the same, you hear the same thing from station to station to station. I think there is a bit of a move to go back, but your automation, does not lead to smooth programming. If nobody pays attention, you can have what I heard on this local station about 2 weeks ago. I was awake in the middle of the night. I tuned in about 10 after 1, and then I kept checking back for 1 hour, and I don't know how much longer it went. They ran all PSAs for 1 hour, just one to another, and then recycle back. Something had gone wrong with their automation. The program they were supposed to have on from syndicated from somewhere didn't come, and there's nobody there to check it. Everybody's gone home. That leads to a lower quality of radio, I think, both technically and in terms of programming. The thing that's going to save AM and FM radio is that they become local again. At least provide some local service in between their syndicated programs. I can hear the same thing on my internet and on my phone and anything else that I can hear on local radio, but I can't get local weather, local traffic, local sports, and all of that. That's what's going to save radio if it's going to be saved. That's my opinion. Because why would you need it if you can get the same programming that everybody else gets across the country off your phone or off your computer or whatever? People can order the book. It's called Radio Survives and Thrives, The History of Kentucky Broadcasting from 1945 to 1970. They can find it at Amazon.com, both in Kindle and in regular print, and they also can find it at Barnes & Noble under their Nook section. It's the print version isn't available at Barnes & Noble, but the Nook version is for those who have electronic readers.